Sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short head.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you're going to hear a speaker from the May 2016 Left Forum panel, a group of us organized, called False Flags: How the United Left Could Defeat a Global Gladio Agenda. And before getting into this, for those of you who don't understand what a Global Gladio Agenda means, it refers to the NATO-CIA-run Operation Gladio that terrorized Europe from the 1950s through the 1980s. I'm going to read from an article called 53 Admitted False Flag Attacks from Washington's blog posted in February of 2015 to explain Operation Gladio. And here goes. There are many documented false flag attacks where a government carries out a terror attack and then falsely blames its enemy for political purposes. And then later in the article, it goes on to say, the former Italian prime minister, an Italian judge, and the former head of Italian counterintelligence admit that NATO, with the help of the Pentagon and CIA, carried out terror bombings in Italy and other European countries in the 1950s and blame the communists in order to rally people's support for their governments in Europe in their fight against communism. As one participant in this formerly secret program stated, quote, you had to attack civilians, people, women, children, innocent people, unknown people far removed from any political game. The reason was quite simple. They were supposed to force these people, the Italian public, to turn to the state to ask for greater security. They also allegedly carried out terror attacks in France, Belgium, Denmark, Germany, Greece, the Netherlands, Norway, Portugal, and UK, and other countries. False flag attacks carried out pursuant to this program include, by way of example only, the murder of the Turkish prime minister in 1960, bombings in Portugal in 1966, the Piazza Fontana massacre in Italy in 1969, terror attacks in Turkey in 1971, the Peteano bombing in Italy in 1972, shootings in Brescia, Italy, and a bombing on an Italian train, 1974, shootings in Istanbul, Turkey, 1977, the Atocha massacre in Madrid, Spain, 1977, the abduction and murder of the Italian prime minister, 1978, the bombing of the Bologna railway station in Italy, 1980, and shooting and killing 28 shoppers in Brabant County, Belgium, in 1985. If you want more information on Operation Gladio, you can do an online search for articles, books, and videos. There's a lot out there on it. Believe me, I'm not making it up. And if you've been paying attention, you also know that 9/11 was a false flag event, falsely blamed on Muslims, used to justify all of the wars in the Middle East and Afghanistan. But now let's get back to the Left Forum, and the speaker you're going to hear today is Richard Dolan. I want to apologize in advance for some of the sound quality. This was taped live, so some of the imperfections were unavoidable. This segment starts out with me introducing Richard Dolan. So here goes.
Well, good morning, everyone. Thanks for coming out. This is our fifth panel on the Deep State, and it is called False Flags: How the United Left Could Defeat a Global Gladio Agenda. Just let me give you the definition of the deep state: is an unelected, unaccountable, militarized corporate security state unaffected by public opinion or elections and beyond the law's reach. We are really fortunate today to have a great panel here with us. It's an honor to be up here with them. They're going to be talking about false flags, as you know, and a false flag are what our deep state does to move their agenda forward and get the public to go along with the horrendous things that they do. We're going to start with Richard Dolan. Richard Dolan is an author, an historian. His soon-to-be-published book, A History of False Flag Operations, details how clandestine agencies secretly engage in violence and destruction in order to promote their agendas. He has published four prior books and numerous articles on anomalous phenomena, suppressed science, secret space programs, breakaway civilizations, the intelligence community, and similar subjects. He's best known as the author of two volumes of history, UFOs and the National Security State. He studied U.S. Cold War strategy, Soviet history, and international diplomacy. So if you please welcome Richard Dolan.
Thank you. Appreciate the welcome. It's an honor to be here, and thank you for inviting me. Yes, I write books about the fringe. I've been doing that for a couple of decades and been the most fascinating journey of my life. I've been focusing now on false flag phenomena operations for the past year and a half. I am in the process of completing a book, hopefully before this year is out. So I guess what I would start is saying, when we look around in our society, I think it's not just those of us here who are very awake and very alert to what's happening in the world around us, but those in our family, friends, people who are not even as focused on zeroing in on the problems of this world. In my town, I live in Rochester, New York. I've seen the evaporation of Eastman Kodak in the last 20 years. It just goes poof. And you see this sense of helplessness that is really pervasive in our society. I believe, you know, in earlier years, I might have thought, well, that's just how things are. But I think this is actually by design. I think that a sense of helplessness is being imposed upon us for very specific reasons. And reason number one is that we're witnessing a theft of our planet. It's happening before our very eyes. We now know the wealthiest 80 people in the world have as much wealth as the entire bottom half of humanity. The 80 wealthy, no, it's actually 60. Pardon me, that number has been recently revised. The top 60 wealthiest individuals on planet Earth have as much accumulated wealth as the entire bottom half of humanity. So when you have a situation like that, and when these people, are, of course, are ensconced in the transnational corporations that dominate everything, that's theft, that's a war. When you have a war like this, the necessary thing for them to do is to rule by or war you by indirection and deception. Because what they don't want us to know is that this whole thing is happening, because then we would maybe have something to do about it. So they require compliance, first and foremost, and they require distraction and deception. Now, a false flag, the way that I've been looking at it lately, is one form, really the nastiest form, but one form of a kind of spectrum of propaganda that is used against us. All right. Some of these forms of propaganda are much more, I don't want to say benign, but much less intense. You know, we start off with the inculcation of just basic cultural values. We go to elementary school and we place our hand over our heart and we pledge allegiance to the flag, and that makes us good citizens. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. We want a certain level of cultural consensus, but it starts the process of working with the system, be a team player. The next level of control or propaganda is a little bit more nasty, and that's, I guess, what we would call the cultural distractions, the Kardashians, you know, dancing with whatever they got on this week, Monday Night Football, and all of this that basically says to us, look over here at this pretty little thing. Don't look over here at the theft that's going on before your eyes. Have fun. Dance with the stars. And so it's increasingly, as we all can see this, an immersive culture that it's a form of brainwashing and distraction. Clearly. Now, there are always those people in our society who want to feel like they're being informed, and so they'll turn on the TV and watch CNN, in which they will then become permanently, forever distracted and confused. And again, this is by design. I used to, you know, I travel a lot, and it's really true. Like in every single airport gate in the country, virtually every airport gate in the country, if you look at the TV screen, you see CNN. And why is this? Is it really a case of every airport manager says, well, I really love CNN, I want to inform the public? Not really. What it is they have a private corporation owned by Time Warner that's got a great deal with the government, and they're able to do it because they are the propaganda voice of the U.S. State Department and CIA. That is what CNN is. So people will turn on the TV, they'll watch CNN, or they'll turn on their establishment news media. And there was a study done, I think, a little over 25 years ago, around the time of the Persian Gulf War. It was during that time. I think out of the University of Colorado. And basically the study was, it's like, oh my God, shock. The more television news people watched, the less they knew about basic geographical facts, like where is Israel on the map? Where is Syria? Where is Russia? And they thought, well, this is a great failing of our news media, but really this is a great success of our television news culture. Right? Really, the purpose isn't to inform, it's really to pull you in for advertising and to distract you. So the whole CNN phenomenon, the MSNBC or Fox or NPR, it really doesn't matter. It literally does not matter. So that whole purpose is to exist within a very narrowly defined spectrum of what is permissible social discourse. And within those boundaries, you must remain. Beyond those boundaries, do not dare to go, or else become shamed and you're out of the discussion. So I would say that those three levels of propaganda probably account for 95% of all of the mind control that exists in our society, and it works very well. But then you have an occasional necessity, let us say, in the minds of those who are wanting to handle us, for stronger measures. And this is when we get into various types of covert operations, whether it's color revolution, regime change, other types of what I'd like to call shock doctrine, opportunism, after the excellent book by Naomi Klein, and then into false flags. So I'll just talk a little bit about those. So again, I look at these all as a spectrum. And it seems to me it's helpful for us to see how false flags fit into this spectrum. And by the way, what I will then conclude with is, because I don't really want to get into the specific false flags. These gentlemen will talk about some of them. There's probably 100. In the book that I'm working on, I think I've identified probably about 100 or so likely false flag events that have shaped our world in the last century. But what I'm more interested in going over here with you today is simply giving a kind of, at least my analytical framework and why I think that this is something that we really need to understand. But when we get into color revolutions, a stronger medicine, as it were, to control us and corral us, these are things really that begin to an argument with your relatives or with some debunker or skeptic on the news bulletin boards. One thing you can tell them is that false flags are in the U.S. Army Psychological Operations Manual. It's right in there. It's in the book. What they now call psychological operations, they don't call them PSYOPs anymore. They call them Military Information Support Operations, or MISO, MISO. So in this manual, they define white, gray, and black operation, black PSYOPs. So white PSYOPs are pretty straightforward. It's basically the U.S. State Department putting out a statement on behalf of the United States government. You know where it's coming from. They're obviously spinning their information, but it's fairly straightforward. That's a white PSYOP. Gray PSYOP is a little different. If you know, many of us are familiar with Operation Mockingbird, that was a gray PSYOP. So it was a situation in which you have proxies in the media basically doing your speaking for you. It's a great thing. If you're doing public speaking and you seed the audience with your cohorts who then pitch you softball questions and make you look smart, that would be a gray PSYOP, I guess you could say. In the U.S. military's formulation of it, a gray PSYOP would be statements by other sources, presumably media sources or NGOs would also be one, that would actually be providing your perspective on things. But it makes it look much more impressive because it's not you saying it, so that's a gray PSYOP. And that was Operation Mockingbird, which Carl Bernstein outed back in 1977, in which we learned that there were at least, I think it's very understated, 400 paid U.S. journalists on the CIA payroll back then. Of course, as we know, the CIA then said, oh no, we don't do that arrangement with journalists anymore. Very legalistic terminology if you really hear the CIA talk like this. Obviously, what we have today is a situation so vastly beyond anything that ever existed in the Mockingbird days. It's beyond the pale. Because it's not just the CIA, it's the military, it's the Pentagon, which spends $4 billion every year on managing its social media. So they're taking your money and my money and then using it to mind job you and propagandize you. Oh, that's great. Thank you. So that's a great PSYOP. The black PSYOP is, and actually I wish I had the quote in front of me. It's okay. A black PSYOP in their manual is literally a situation in which agents or actors who are part of the U.S. system create an act that is then attributed to another party. It could be another country or another party. That is literally a false flag. One of the interesting things they say in this manual is that that type of activity is not something that military personnel do, that this is the reserve of intelligence, whether it's military intelligence, Army, Navy intelligence, Air Force intelligence, or CIA, or some other intelligence group, but not the military. And again, this is explicitly stated in the current U.S. Military Psychological Operations Manual. I think it's rather interesting. So again, if you're in a debate with your friends or adversaries, this is part of the playbook. But there's a spectrum, as I said before. So one thing that the United States has mastered the art of is the color revolution kind of protocol. And many of us are familiar with what happened in Iran in 1953. Kermit Roosevelt, grandson of TR, helps to organize Operation Ajax, in which Mossadegh is taken out, God forbid, because he really took shell oil out of Iran and can't do that. So he's got to go. Well, after the fall of the Soviet Union, we have the perfection of the so-called peaceful revolutions. We call them the color revolutions. Georgia in 03 had the Rose Revolution. Ukraine in 04 had the Orange Revolution and so on. These are supposedly people-generated movements to get rid of authoritarian governments, which then inevitably become very, very pro-Western, pro-corporate, just so happens. Well, this is, again, by design. So we know that these are promoted and funded with billionaire money. George Soros, very much involved in this whole thing. Koch brothers are doing this right now in Brazil against Dilma Rousseff. Same type of protocol. So you have a situation in which money goes into these countries, destabilizes them, finds a wedge by which to open up the society, particularly getting young people to get worked up over a particular issue. It's easy to do. And you get them to the streets, and boom, next thing you know, you're inciting revolution. And sometimes, if you're the CIA, you'll have your snipers on the rooftops, like in Ukraine, killing people and attributing it to the government. So that's the color revolution protocol. And what's amazing about it is the U.S. has become so good at this. There's no one in the world can do what the U.S. does in this regard. I'm going to talk about why in like about 1 minute. Beyond color revolutions and provocations, agent provocateurs and crowds and so forth, inciting violence, this is an old story, of course, it goes on to this day, and in fact, it's spread more and more. It's global. The real difficulty in separating false flags, let me phrase it this way. There's one difficulty in identifying a false flag, and that is distinguishing it from what I call the shock doctrine opportunism. So Naomi Klein's excellent book, Shock Doctrine, and she has a very important insight. She's talking about how the U.S. runs the world militarily by shock and awe, which is really one of the most incredible expressions. Think about this. Your own government's like shocking and awing other countries. Well, she had the insight that this is not simply how we rule militarily, but how we rule at home, through trauma, through shock. So she talked about Katrina. She talked about 9/11. And she wasn't talking about them as false flags, but she was talking about them as traumatic events in which people are bereft. They're kind of on their back psychologically, and they're looking to the government for help. And it's at that moment she points out that these plans roll out, corporate takeover of New Orleans after Katrina, national security protocols after 9/11, the whole USA Patriot Act fascist takeover. So all of these are, I guess she would see, I don't want to misquote her, but as a kind of evil opportunism. I think this is exactly very much part of our world. But I would say there are instances in which agencies go a step further and they make these things happen, and that's a false flag. And distinguishing between opportunism and false flag, I would have to say, is probably not always going to be easy. And maybe it's not always even necessary. Because I think we're getting to a point in our world where, you know, if you really know how to ride that horse known as the public, you know when things are going to happen. And sometimes it's in your interest just to let them happen, or maybe just nudge them a little bit. So we're getting into a very, very sophisticated kind of gray area here. These handlers are very good at what they do. The reason that we have false flags permeating our world today, you know, there are people, you go on the web and they'll talk about false flags as an ancient phenomenon. And when I started looking into this, I was inclined to accept that. I don't believe that anymore. I think false flags are a distinctively modern phenomenon. There may be some ancient false flags, but they're the outliers, not the rule. Nero burning down Rome, I actually doubt it. I don't think that's what happened, blaming it on the Christians. But even if it is, it's an exception to the rule. Basically, false flags, with a few exceptions, begin in earnest after the First World War. And the reason for this is very simple. The world is militarized after the First World War, so we actually now have covert op teams that exist, which didn't exist before, at least sophisticated ones. Secondarily, we have the now birth, really, of the modern media propaganda system. And this is an absolute necessity. And we have this situation after the First World War in which certain governments particularly dominated their national media. We're talking Germany, Japan, Soviet Union, which really initiated the first real true false flags of our era in the 1930s. Don't need to get into them. They're mostly international, other than the Reichstag, the Manchuria's false flag, invasion of Poland, obviously, invasion of Finland was a false flag by the Soviets. These are international. They were really early types of false flags in our modern era. What we see after the Second World War is a transformation of this phenomenon. It becomes much more domestic. So the tools are being used against populations. And in the false flag Olympics after the Second World War, the United States runs away with the gold medal. There's no question about it. And the reason for this, and I'm now going to jump ahead and wrap up why this is conceptually really so important. False flags, we had Gladio in the 50s, we had COINTELPRO, we had a lot of other things. We had the U.S. and the British funding the Muslim Brotherhood in the 1950s to take down Nasser in Egypt. They didn't like the fact that you had this independent Egyptian leader who was not going to be part of any of the blocs. And they said, well, he's got to go, so they funded the head-chopping jihadists back then. Well, it didn't work against Nasser. But hey, why stop a good thing? And they just kept it going. And they do that to this day, clearly. But the reason false flags are necessary from their point of view today is twofold. Let's go back to Seattle in 1999. All right, the WTO protests. And you have a situation in which an entire middle class of a nation is being disemboweled, which is really what we've got. When people believe they have rights, they're really not going to take that lying down. They'll protest, as they did in Seattle, when more than 40,000 people shut that entire city down. in the WTO protests. They literally prevented delegates from entering the building. Tear gas didn't work. Pepper spray didn't work. This is an unmanageable situation from the point of view of those people at the very top of our food chain. This is 18, 19 months before 9/11. So what 9/11 meant is that the hammer came down on us, beat us over the head with a big national security stick, and away goes this idea of people protest. Now, if you protest, which many of us here do, we know you're photographed, you're in a database. It's an act of intimidation at the very least and coercion at the most. And this has now become the norm. So globalization, neoliberalist, transcorporate domination agenda, this is one of the key pillars of why false flags are necessary. There needs to be a pretext to intimidate the population. The other pillar, why false flags are necessary today, is, I would say, is the petrodollar system, which is really the foundation of the U.S. empire internationally. You know, the U.S. went off the gold standard in 1971 simply because the Vietnam War caused us to crank out the dollars. The U.S. was hinged to gold. The dollar suddenly was not really reflecting the price of gold accurately. Nations realized this. We started hemorrhaging gold out of Fort Knox because the dollar was really overvalued. And Nixon took the dollar off the gold standard temporarily, by which he meant permanently, and that saved the gold problem. It did not save the dollar problem. There's the danger of all these dollars coming back. There's really no intrinsic reason for nations to hold on to the dollar if there's no U.S. dollar gold standard. Enter Henry Kissinger 2 years later, makes a deal with Saudi Arabia, says, we will support your evil, tyrannical ninth century regime forever, give you all the weapons you want, as long as you sell all your oil in dollars, accepting no other currency. Saudis are cool with that. All the other OPEC nations go on board, and the U.S. is back on easy street. And the necessity, it's a horrible crime that Americans are not educated in this fundamental fact. Almost every important feature of American foreign policy has some relation to a dollar. It must be maintained. And when the threats come to the system, such as Saddam Hussein in 2000 starts selling his oil in euros, that can't happen. So we create the fictitious weapons of mass destruction charade. Muammar Gaddafi, a few years later, is about to introduce a gold-based dinar. Cannot happen. You create fictions about carpet bombing your population during the Arab Spring and so forth, and you have them killed. And, you know, they wanted to do the same thing with Syria, which wasn't a direct threat to the petrodollar system, but geopolitically is allied with those groups that do threaten the petrodollar system and has to be taken down as well. So I think what we're seeing is, as long as this situation is in place, and the other reasons we have to have false flags from their point of view is we have a situation in which we've got international law which says wars are wrong after the First World War, and a situation in which nations are ostensibly democratic. And I say ostensibly. Almost every nation in the world now is ostensibly democratic, with very few exceptions. And so what that means is governments have to have the pretext of rule by the people. And this is why they need to corral public opinion the way that they do. All right, so it's when an international law says, now law, war is wrong, you can't have wars of aggression and so forth. So you've got to create these pretexts. False flags are the ultimate tool in the propaganda toolkit for this. We're now in an era post 9/11 in which, you know, when you're creating a kind of global police state, and this is exactly what we're seeing, of course, you have to go by degree, step by step by step by step by step to intimidate and modify the behavior of entire populations. So each successive false flag that we see, or each successful form of manipulation we see, they're not all on the order of 9/11, of course. They don't have to be. They can be smaller false flags, but each one is, it's like a specialized weapon designed for a specialized goal and agenda. You know, in the case of the Boston Marathon bombing, which, yes, absolutely, I think the primary focus of that was to roll out the militarized police. That is now a ubiquitous fact of American life, in which you have 19,000 militarized police breaking into the homes of Boston residents as if there's no big deal. Well, we've gone through all that now. That's part of what we are. But some of the mass shootings, sure, there's undoubtedly gun control motivations in it, but there's also psychological profiling motivations in there. Sandy Hook is a perfect case in point, where you have legislation coming out to now, oh, let's create psychological profile screening of the population, mental health, and so forth. Last thing I'll just say is, how do we identify these? What we're seeing is almost like a Cold War, a psychological Cold War going on between the deep state and us. All right. So as we learn more, they adapt. So one of the things that you see with these false flags, when you see a major, horrific, traumatic event happen and an immediate media focus to identify the culprit, in which within days, everything seems to be all figured out, we really have to be very suspicious. It doesn't prove that it's a false flag. The only thing that proves a false flag is good independent journalism and investigation. But there are profiles of these. The existence of the multiple drills often is the case. I don't know if that will continue indefinitely because I think people are onto this. But you had it with 9/11. You had it with London, the two bombings of 7/7/05. You had it with some of the shootings, Aurora, Colorado, and I believe San Bernardino, and there are others in Paris as well. You have these drills going on, and what's the point of these drills? The drills to protect against the exact event that happens. What a coincidence. Well, I think the reason for this has happened many times, very deeply suspicious. Well, reason number one is that, you know, it's helpful in providing confusion to the day to impede proper response to the event itself. But I think the real reason is deeper in the planning stages. If I'm working on a false flag and you're in the intelligence community and you're my colleague and you're not on the on the inside of it, but you learn about this somehow in advance of it, I can simply say to you, no, no, we're doing a drill. So it would really disable an independent investigation within in the intelligence group. And I think that's actually an important part of it. But the thing is, we're learning these tricks, and now I think that we're going to see adaptations in the future. I think moving forward, we have to look for more adaptations and variations in false flags. They're not all simply going to be military events. They're not all simply going to be shootings and bombings. They're corporate. They are a variety of forms of psychological manipulation, often in a very subtle, sophisticated way. And, you know, we moved a long, long way from the actual false flags of the pirate days. Would that we were as honorable as the pirates. You know, and when they would give you a false flag, they would literally raise the flag of another country, Britain or Netherlands, and then you'd come up to them, but then they would raise the black flag, and you know it's pirates robbing your ship. At least they had that much of a sense of honor. We're so far removed from that. The last thing I would just say is we're reminded of Thomas Jefferson, eternal vigilance is the price of freedom. And this is true. What we have to do is not despair. We have to just wake up ourselves, wake up other people around us, and be brave. I believe that it is absolutely possible for us on an individual basis and on a social basis to organize and to fight this. It's really the only choice we have. We're moving into a global society. The real question is it going to look like freedom or is it going to look like fascism? And I think we want it to look like freedom. Thank you very much.
And again, you were just listening to a presentation given by author Richard Dolan at the May 2016 Left Forum in New York City. The full video of the false flag panel he was part of is posted on YouTube. I encourage you to check it out. And now to close out the show, I'm going to read a few more of these false flag attacks from the Article 58 admitted false flag attacks. So here goes. Japanese troops set off a small explosion on a train track in 1931 and falsely blamed it on China in order to justify an invasion of Manchuria. A major with the Nazi SS admitted at the Nuremberg trials that under orders from the chief of the Gestapo, he and some other Nazi operatives faked attacks on their own people and resources, which they blamed on the Poles to justify an invasion of Poland. The British Prime Minister admitted to his defense secretary that he and American President Dwight Eisenhower approved a plan in 1957 to carry out attacks in Syria and blame it on the Syrian government as a way to effect regime change. The NSA admitted that it lied about what really happened in the Gulf of Tonkin incident in 1964, manipulating data to make it look like North Vietnamese boats fired on a U.S. ship so as to create a false justification for the Vietnam War. A U.S. congressional committee admitted that as part of its COINTELPRO campaign, the FBI had used many provocateurs in the 1950s through 70s to carry out violent acts and falsely blame them on political activists. Senior police officials in Genoa, Italy, admitted that in July 2001 at the G8 summit in Genoa, it planted two Molotov cocktails and faked the stabbing of a police officer in order to justify a violent crackdown against protesters. Although the FBI now admits that the 2001 anthrax attacks were carried out by one or more U.S. government scientists, a senior FBI official says that the FBI was actually told to blame the anthrax attacks on Al-Qaeda by White House officials. A former U.S. intelligence officer recently alleged, "Most terrorists are false flag terrorists or are created by our own security services." The head and special agent in charge of the FBI's Los Angeles office said that most terror attacks are committed by the CIA and FBI as false flags. So don't be duped. Whenever there's a new terrorist attack, please make sure you do your homework before you believe what the government and media are telling you. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.